KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. A Seattle Times Sunday front page article about a woman's mysterious past grabbed a lot of reader attention. We're going to talk with reporter Maureen O'Hagan about her story and why the Seattle Times decided to work with investigators to find out this mysterious woman's identity. Also ahead this hour, our gardening panel joins us to take your calls and questions. A new study out of Stanford University shows charter schools across the country are both attracting more students and in some cases doing a better job educating those students than public schools. Dr. Margaret Raymond led the study. She joins us now. Hello.
Hello, Marcy.
What primarily were you interested in finding out going into this study?
Well, we had studied charter schools 4 years ago and released a report in 2009 that showed that charter schools were, on average, not doing as well educating their students as their peers in traditional public schools. And at that time, the charter sector in the United States got pretty serious about trying to improve quality, so we wanted to go back and take another look.
How many schools and students did you include in this study?
So we were lucky enough to be able to include charter schools from 27 states out of the 43 that allow them to operate. And across those 27 states, 95% of all the charter school students in the United States attend schools in those states.
And so you were looking at public school students who were in the same geographic area or who were in the schools that these charter school students would have attended?
It's the latter. We have a way of matching charter school students to twins that look exactly like them but attend schools that the charter school students would attend had they not gone to the charter school.
So you were comparing test results from essentially those twin schools.
Well, they're not twin schools. They're twin students.
Okay,
and
twin
so
students.
What we have is a little bit like Noah's Ark. We have them two by two,
okay.
And in every pair, one is a charter school student and one is a traditional twin.
Okay. In general, in what areas did you see improvements in the charter schools?
Well, we saw overall that the typical charter school student had made much progress compared to 2009. They'd gained an additional 14 days of learning compared to the typical charter student 4 years ago in reading and 22 days of additional learning compared to 4 years ago in mathematics. And where this brings them compared to their public school twins is that they are now slightly ahead. They have 7 more days per year of learning in reading, and they've pulled even in math. And so this shows that the charter school sector's attention to quality has really paid off.
When you say equivalent of 7 days more learning, does that mean time of instruction? What does that mean?
No, so we're actually using days of learning as the outcome measure of what they actually know at the end of the year. And so what we're doing here is comparing to a typical school year in the traditional sector, which across the country is about 180 days. We're saying, so in charter schools, relative to that standard, how many days, fewer days of learning or how many more days of learning do they get relative to that? So it's an outcome measure, not a measure of time on task.
And could you correlate these findings to a particular type, I guess generalized to a particular type of student, i.e. low income, racial minority, a geographic
look? So, Marcy, we did a lot of different comparisons, and the most interesting findings for us were the ones that looked at particular student subgroups. Our research group is particularly interested in finding out ways to help students who come to school with education disadvantages, either by the fact that they have had a historically underserved status as a minority student or living in poverty or they're English language learners. And what we found is that for blacks and for students in poverty and English language learners, we find much better learning gains in charter schools than they would have obtained had they gone to traditional schools. And where students come with multiple disadvantages, and here I'm talking about minority status and living in poverty, or Hispanic and being an English language learner, we found those benefits even more compounded and positive for charter school students.
Why do you think that you saw those improvements?
Well, we have not had a chance to look at individual practices in charter schools, in other words, differences in the way they operate. But across states, we see so much differences from state to state that we are able to say that policies by which charters are allowed to operate matter a lot. And here I'm talking about the degree to which charters enjoy autonomy, which is something that traditional public schools do not have. They're allowed to operate with greater flexibility. They can design their schools and their instructional programs as they see fit. They have local control over resources so that they can model their schools and allocate their budgets and staffing to meet student needs and change those when necessary. And we have authorizers, these are the organizations that oversee charter schools, having the authority to close schools when it's clear that they're just not making it.
These
are differences that the traditional schools do not have.
At least one prominent critic of charter schools, or skeptic, Diane Radovich, says that she expected to see bigger gains from the charter schools because they have that flexibility than what your study indicates.
So I think there's no one who studies education that doesn't dream of larger gains, and I certainly understand that desire. I would like to point out, though, that these are gains of 14 days in reading compared to 4 years ago and 22 days of learning in math. That's slow and steady progress, and I don't know of any other reform policy that's able to claim those kinds of gains.
So Washington State voters recently, after a lot of attempts, approved a law that would allow charter school formation. Based on your study, and this is the second of two that you've done, what would you advise people who want to start the schools to think about to create an effective charter school?
So I think my advice is actually more aimed at the organizations that are empowered to permit charters to operate and have the responsibility to oversee them. I think it's very important for us as a nation to make sure that charters are only given to operators that have promise of really high quality operations. So we really want to have the charter school authorizers be quite attentive to quality at the front door, and also to have both attention and the political will to take action if necessary at the end of the charter term. That said, there's a lot of experience within the charter sector about operating high-quality schools. We see in our study that there are now thousands of charter schools that are doing better than their local option. We think that this is an opportunity for funders and policymakers and operators to take a look around and try to mirror some of the performance in those high-quality schools.
So when you use that term high quality, and you talked a little bit earlier about the freedom for people running these schools to get rid of programs or educators who aren't measuring up to a certain standard, is it really the freedom for trial and error that is at the heart of high quality? What's at the heart of it?
So I wouldn't really call it trial and error. What I would call it is continuous improvement. We can look at communities around the country, and I would offer for you New Orleans and District of Columbia and Boston as examples, where they've decided that the way to improve the sector of quality of charter schools is to focus on quality. They try to improve their selection rules and protocols as they go forward so that they can learn from generation of school to next generation of schools what to look for in their applications. And we say in the report that we really hope that we can develop a knowledge base about what great applicants need to have in terms of their early designs and operation that give promise to having better schools than just a random sort of open a school and see if it works.
And just a last question about sort of the bar by which one measures. You used a battery of standardized tests. Is there any other kind of measure that one could use to look at whether the outcome is positive? For example, there are things that you can't measure in terms of developing critical thinking skills that aren't necessarily easily testable.
So I hold out hope that the new comprehensive tests that are going to come online that go with the adoption of the Common Core learning standards will, in fact, provide us that greater breadth of insight into not only the content of what students know, but how well they are able to work with the knowledge that they have. In the meantime, I do think that there are other measures that we can look at. We advocate in the report that we look not only at how much a student progresses in a year, but how much they absolutely know at the end of the year. So we think that both growth and achievement is important. And as you get closer to high school and beyond, the absolute content of what you know becomes more important because that's a measure of your readiness to go on to do other things after high school. So we advocate that we use mixed measures, progress towards graduation, a look at growth and a look at achievement, and eventually this deeper understanding of ability to think more conceptually.
Dr. Raymond, thank you for taking time to talk with us about your study today.
Well, thank you, Marcy. It's nice to talk with you. Take care.
Dr. Margaret Raymond is director of the Center for Research in Education Outcomes, CREDO, at Stanford University. CREDO just released a national study of charter school performance today. This is Weekday on KUOW.
Ten 19, sleuthing a mysterious woman's identity in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Sodo Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor organic garden supplies and hydroponics, featuring organic bison soil, sanctuary soils, and cutting-edge solutions, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sodohydro.com.
62 degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle, expecting showers this afternoon and a high of 69. Then it's showers overnight and probably more showers tomorrow. Tomorrow's high, 71. Tips for tending your summer garden in, about 15, 20 minutes from now.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman, and this is Weekday. If you read the Seattle Times, on Sunday you might have noticed a long story about a mystery woman. Investigators are trying to figure out who she was. She committed suicide a couple years ago. It turned out that she wasn't the woman that her husband thought she was when he married her, and nobody really knows who she might have been. Seattle Times reporter Maureen O'Hagan wrote the Seattle Times story, and she joins us now. Hello, Maureen.
Hi, Marcy.
Well, let's start with Lori Ruff. What do we know about this mystery woman?
Well, her name is Lori Ruff. She married a fellow named Blake Ruff. In 2010, she killed herself. And when the two of them got married, Blake's family asked her all the normal questions. Tell me about your life, who you are, where'd you go to school? And she wouldn't answer anything. The family was suspicious about this. In any case, after she died, they went to her house and they found this strong box. And inside the strong box was a birth certificate in someone else's name, the name Becky Sue Turner. There was also a name change document showing that Lori had changed her name from Becky Sue to Lori in 1988. The family came to find out that Becky Sue Turner was actually a child that died in a fire here in Fife in 1988. So Lori had stolen Becky Sue's identity.
And the family, the Ruff family, knew none of this.
No, they didn't know any of it. And at first I thought, how could her husband not know? He's just a different kind of guy, and he doesn't ask a lot of questions. He was just willing to accept Lori as she was.
Blake and Lori had a child. They had a daughter. Is that what prompted them to search for who she might have been?
Well, I think that's part of it. I mean, I think the family was, the extended family was suspicious all along. But they also say, you know, they want to answer to this question, but they feel like they want to be able to tell the little girl who her mother was, you know, when she's old enough to understand all this.
So who is this man, Joe Velling, who comes into your story?
He's an investigator, and he's based here in Seattle. He works for the Social Security Administration, and he's an expert on identity theft and Social Security fraud. He wound up getting this case. Lori had obviously committed Social Security fraud in order to get steal this identity and take this dead child's Social Security number. And so he's been trying to figure out who Lori really was for almost 2 years now, and he's kind of at his wit's end trying to figure it out.
So how did the Seattle Times and you in particular get involved?
I wrote a story that had something to do with him some years ago when he finally got to the end point in his investigation where he had no more leads to follow. He thought, maybe I'll call the newspaper. So he called us and he said, I think I might have a story for you. It's definitely an unusual story for the newspaper in that it is a mystery and we don't know the answer and we're asking readers to help us solve it by looking at this woman's picture and the clues, seeing if they can identify her.
So when I'm curious sort of procedurally, let me take a step back. When somebody calls you with something like this, which you say is unusual for the newspaper, do you present it to editors and say, hey, what do you think? And I'm curious what they did think.
Yeah, it was. I do present it to them, and I right away thought this is a really interesting story. If it fascinates me, it's probably interesting to other people too. I just a gut thing. It's funny. A couple of years ago, we had a similar thing where a fellow showed up here with amnesia. He had no idea who he was, and we published a story in 2009. And at that time, the editors took a little convincing. They said, "Well, you got to solve the mystery in order to." Put it in the paper, and they were open-minded, though. We didn't solve the mystery. We put it in the paper. Within hours, somebody in China recognized this fellow and said, I know who he is, and we were able to identify this guy with amnesia. So I think they were primed for this sort of story.
Okay, so right away, somebody from China identified that person. Has anybody identified Lori Ruff?
We haven't got anything solid yet, but the story is getting a lot of interest all over the country. It's been our top read story for 3 days running now, I guess. We're still getting tons of emails. There's online comments. There's a form people can fill out, and the investigator, as we speak, is trying to follow some leads. He's actually going to be here for a live online chat at 2 o'clock this afternoon if anybody wants to tune in.
Well, I'm curious, is the main reason that the search is based here because of the connection to this baby in Fife?
That's part of it. I think I may have misspoke earlier. She died in 1971, but
okay.
That's part of it. But there's also some other connections to the Northwest. Lori, her first ID in Becky Sue Turner's name, the dead child, that was a ID card out of Boise. And it appears that she did live in Boise at this time because she showed up in person at the state ID office. There's also a post office box in Nevada that she had that was forwarded to her in Dallas. She had ultimately settled in the Dallas area. And she didn't speak with any accent. And there's maybe some speculation that, well, how did she know about Becky Sue Turner? Did she read the obituary years ago? Did she walk by her gravesite? Did she know the family? So those are some of the reasons why the investigator's here.
You know, it's interesting. I'm sure that there are readers who have said, well, you know, there must be some reason that she wanted a different identity. It's not necessarily a nefarious reason. Maybe she was just incredibly unhappy. And so is there a reason to dig up that past?
Well, I think there's a lot of different sides of that argument, and there have been readers that said, you know, leave the poor woman alone. that could be the case. I think from the investigator's point of view, this is someone who committed Social Security fraud, and they don't like that sort of thing. you know, it could be that something horrible happened to her years ago, or that she did something awful, and maybe that's worth finding out, too.
Well, so Maureen O'Hagan, what happens from your end as a reporter, not as the newspaper itself? What do you do with this story now?
Well, I'm hoping that readers can figure it out and we can do a follow-up. I keep going back and forth in my head being hopeful that readers will solve it and being dejected that they haven't solved it already.
And in the 4 days since the story came up, 3 days?
It may be I'm expecting a little too much. But at the same time, I was thinking, boy, I do hope at some point they solve this, because otherwise this is going to be a just sort of hanging and no closure for a lot of people.
Well, there sounds like there's a book in it for you, if nothing else.
Well, I don't know. I'll have to think about that.
Maureen O'Hagan is a Seattle Times reporter. Her story about Lori Ruff, mystery woman, and the search for the identity ran on Sunday in the Seattle Times. And today at 2 o'clock is a live chat with Joe Velling, the Social Security investigator.
Right, 2 o'clock, and you can look online and see some of the clues that were in the strong box the family found.
Oh, Maureen, thank you so much for telling us about your end in the Seattle Times end in this search for the mystery woman.
Thanks for having me.
Listening to KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman.
Sixty-three degrees in Seattle. Forecast says a high today of 69 with clouds and showers. It's 10:28. Wit and wisdom with our organic gardening panel in a minute.
The United States holds a special green card lottery each year. The winners, more than 50,000 immigrants, many from Africa.
The only visa type that has a high proportion of Africans that come through is the diversity visa.
The immigration bill in the Senate would put an end to that. A debate over the diversity visa next time on The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m.
Join KUOW for Bumbershoot, featuring 3 days of art, comedy, and music at Seattle Center this Labor Day weekend. The 2013 lineup includes local band Death Cab for Cutie, playing transatlanticism, heart, and more. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
I'm Bernard Willett. It's 10:29. What Secretary of State John Kerry is saying about NSA leaker Edward Snowden in the news at 11.
You might be grousing about the rain that I think is falling on and off outside, but I have to say the gardens really love the water. How is your garden doing? Our panel is here once again to answer your questions, and alphabetically they are Laura Matter, practicing horticulturalist and coordinator for Seattle Tilth's Garden Hotline, Greg Rayburn, the Vashon Basin steward and co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk, and Marty Winget, who writes about gardening and travel, and you can find out more at her website, MartyWinget.com. Welcome, all of you.
Good morning.
One of my coworkers asked this morning whether she needed to put some sort of cover over her tomato plants because of the rain. Do we need to worry if we've got little tomatoes that they're going to split?
Wouldn't hurt.
That's a really good question. There are some diseases, that are brought on by soil splashing up onto the tomato. So even if you can't cover them, putting some kind of mulch on the ground probably would be beneficial to keep that soil from getting onto the leaves.
Do we have to worry, we've seen quite a bit of rain, about fruit splitting, tomato fruit in particular, but there's probably other
fruit. Not yet.
No, not the tomatoes, that's for sure. I don't grow any cherries, so I don't know how that would be.
Cherries could, strawberries maybe. Sometimes strawberries get a little swollen with too much rain, but... We've had a pretty good strawberry season so far.
206-543-5869 is our phone number, 206-543-KUOW or 1-800-289-5869. You can email us as well, which several people have already done, weekday at KUOW.org. Eric emails to talk about the Sustainable Ballard's 5th Annual Edible Garden Tour. Any of you know about that?
Yeah, that's this weekend.
And I think it's posted on the Green Day's Facebook page, too.
It is, but just thought we'd shout out in the day. Edible gardens, sort of, we talk a lot about interspersing edibles, but can you make a totally edible ornamental garden?
Sure.
Yeah?
Sure.
Well, I know, Laura, you're probably all set for me to do that.
my pea patch bed actually would be a good example of that. But if you were to come to the Seattle Tilth Gardens, you could see a good example of that as well, because a lot of those are edible plants. In fact, I think probably primarily, whether they're herbs or fruit trees or shrubs. So there's a lot of perennial things.
There's a great book by Ellen Zachos, Z-A-C-H-O-S, on foraging. And she, I've heard her talk, and she talks about eating hosta leaves and...
Really?
Oh, yeah. Everything.
You can eat hosta leaves?
You need to take
all
a look at that book.
Things, yeah.
Wow. Hosta seems like something that would be toxic, especially those big bluish ones, which are they're very beautiful, but I have not thought about eating them. Bernadette emails, here's a quick question. My older rhubarb is getting enough water, but the stalks are too thin, though still tasty. I added a mulch of manure compost about an inch. No improvement. There's been some increased shade in the area. I've not separated the rhubarb, only moved it as a large ball 8 years ago. Any ideas? Is it not enough light? Do I need to separate it? Not enough manure? Thanks.
I think she's on the right track. I think separating the plant and also more light will help that.
Separating sounds so easy, but you really have to hack at those things. I would take a little wood axe or something, hatchet.
Yeah. Really?
They're
that
amazing.
Tough? Do you have to worry about damaging the root? A hatchet doesn't.
Not too much. You can take a small piece of that and it'll grow back into a huge plant.
Really? You just hack it apart? So it's. I did that once with iris. It was hard.
Yeah.
It's hard on us.
Oh, no, I can't do it. It'll hurt the plant.
Yeah, well, that's how I feel about thinning radishes, too, which is why I don't grow them anymore. 206-543-KUOW. Hi, Nancy in Lake City. Thank you for joining us. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been hearing good things about corn gluten as a way to prevent the germination of weeds that may be in the soil. And I saw some for sale recently, and I wanted to know if anyone knows of the efficacy of that product.
So it can help reduce the amount of seed germination, but it's also a great bird food. So I know that some of the municipalities that have experimented with using it, they've just been followed by the crows.
Yes, and it's a great fertilizer for perennial weeds that may still be in the soil. It does. It's an organic pre-emergent herbicide, but also short-lived because it rains and
it's
gone.
Yeah. So it works by inhibiting the radical on the seed from emerging, the first part of the root, and then if it rains too much, it disperses that effect, and then you don't get as good a control.
So I'm hearing
yes, it works, but
in the Northwest,
yeah, not great. Does that answer your question, Nancy?
Stops, and we get our summertime. I could give it a try.
Yes, if we get we are going to get our summertime
this weekend
for 2 days.
Enjoy it.
Yeah,
a hoe works really well too.
A hoe
as a post-emergent weeding tool.
You want some sweat equity.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to sweat much if you get them when they're little. Right after they germinate, then you can disturb them.
When it's cold out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was gone for 2 years, and the caretakers of my garden didn't appear to know a weed from a fence post. And I go out with my hoe every single day for an hour and a half, making out the emerging weeds. So I'll try anything.
Well, ketchup is so hard.
Good luck with that corn gluten experiment. Let us know how that works. Curious about that. In fact, Nick Bond, the state climatologist, said that the forecast models call for, once we're done with this hump here, for a drier summer. So maybe that's true. I don't know. It'd be nice. 206-543-KUOW. 1-800-289-5869. Judy says, hello, now that my peonies have bloomed, what do I do to them? I don't know. I look at them? I take care of them, I'm assuming?
I look at mine.
Do you?
They have very interesting seed pods. Mm-hmm. So it's always fun to watch them split open and see the red and black seeds inside. And one of them I can't remember which one is the fertile one, but it's an indication of which. Never mind. The foliage of peonies is quite attractive and turns a nice tawny color in the fall. So as long as it doesn't have any disease on it, I would just enjoy it.
So it's not like a rose or something that you deadhead and knew.
And it'll rebloom? No. Yeah. Sorry. Wouldn't that be nice?
It would be. I think they're gorgeous right now. They seem sort of at their height of beauty. So just enjoy them. That's the answer to your question. Hi, Michael in Wedgwood. You're on the air.
Hi. So I bought 4 4-inch pots of Cipollino, I think they're called onions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I should have not planted them in 4 clumps, but I did. So my question is, what do I do now?
So
because they're each looking like a tiny little white onion, but they're all on top of each other.
You know, you could separate them. Right now would be a good time to do it with the rain that's going on.
And how far apart?
They don't get really huge bulbs on them, and at this time of year, you know, their bulbing is not going to get maximized because they weren't put in early enough. But you could do, 4 inches apart on those and be safe with that.
And can I eat are the greens kind of scallion-y?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, perfect. So the enjoyment starts today.
Yes.
Enjoy those onion stalks.
Thanks for your call.
Thank
you. Bye-bye.
Bye. I just learned this from Deborah Madison, that edible plants, for the most part, you can eat a lot of parts that we never thought we could eat.
Most of them. I wouldn't eat your tomato leaves or
tasty, but things like radish greens and
carrot greens.
Yeah, things that you never thought that you could eat, you can eat. But maybe you should read this book first before you eat them. 206-543-KUOW is our phone number. Laura Matter, Greg Rayburn, and Marty Wingett are here. Our Green Days gardening panel. Consuelo joins us from Ballard. Hello.
Hi. First of all, another shout-out for Sustainable Ballard Garden Tour this weekend. Please come. It's going to be wonderful. We've got lots of exciting gardens. And I have a question for you about the rhododendron blight that seems to be hitting Seattle. What is that about, and what should we do about it?
Well, there is a powdery mildew that hits rhododendrons. Is that possibly what you're thinking about?
I mean, it's all over. I look around. It's on our roadies. It's all over Ballard. It's over at the U District.
Right.
Like the leaves are black spots. It doesn't look like a powdery mildew.
Well, yes, that's true, and that makes it even more irritating to us. The powdery mildew that hits rhododendrons does not look like what we think of as powdery mildew. And unfortunately, some of the most popular cultivars are susceptible. I think Unique is susceptible, which is a gorgeous rhododendron. And, you know, I'm not the biggest rhodie fan, but I love that one. And I'm not sure about control, Laura.
It's more a matter of kind of tolerance with it and keeping it from getting too bad. What you're going to see is more splotchiness. If you look at the underside of the leaf, sometimes you can see a little bit of that white film that you would see on other plants. It gets kind of purple splotching. That can deepen and look more like your real spotting. Sometimes they're kind of yellow spotted, too, as it's starting. Putting air circulation through the plant by thinning the plant will be helpful. Also, trying to reduce humidity in the area. Powdery mildew is kind of an anomaly in the fungal world. It actually spreads by airborne spores and doesn't like a film of water on the leaf.
Oh.
That doesn't encourage it. That actually discourages it. But there are baking soda sprays you can make and you know, try to keep it. That changes the pH on the leaf surface, and you can kind of keep it at bay. But I don't think you're ever going to get rid of it.
If you're thinking of planting a rhododendron, then I would suggest you look at some of the selections that have hairy leaves, like the Yacushimanum rhododendrons have a slightly hairy leaf, and apparently the powdery mildew spores can't take hold.
And I'm not sure specifically with rhododendrons, but with other plants, they become more susceptible through drought stress if they're not. So some supplemental watering can really help them.
Well, so they should be thrilled this week with this rain. Well, good luck with that, Consuelo. And your garden is on the Sustainable Ballard Garden Tour? I think she's gone. Well, but she's urging you to come. We have a lot of emails, so let me suggest callers to call 543-5869 or 1-800-289-5869. Amy in the Pinehurst neighborhood says, I have a red currant bush that's about 3 years old. This year it has tons of green berries, and I was looking forward to eating them. Then I found a little green caterpillar on a leaf eating around the edge of it. Then I found more. I fed these caterpillars to my chickens. Then I let my chickens dig around the base of the plant. And then the berries started turning black and dropping off the bush. I quit seeing worms on the leaves. I decided to try eating one of the berries. I looked at it closely. And before I popped it into my mouth, I found a perfectly round hole surrounded by a brown area. There was a worm inside. Almost all the berries have dropped off. What can I do for next year?
Oh, there are a couple different pests for those guys. And, you know, I'm not going to try and quote you the names because I always get them mixed up. But there is one that eats the leaf and one that goes into the fruit. Sounds like you have both going on there. Hard to grow in this area because of that. Boy.
So currants are hard to grow?
Because of those pests, yeah.
Yeah, the spotted-winged Drosophila leaves that little, that's
yeah.
what I was thinking
and
with the fruit.
It could be the spotted-winged Drosophila, but there's also another kind of worm that gets into currants. So you're kind of doomed in some ways with currants. There's so many things that like to eat them. You might try, what works for spotted-winged Drosophila, one of the things they're finding is some really, really, really fine mesh netting. Over the top of it, and maybe you do that.
You would have to do that early in the season.
Well, you have to do it right after you feel like your flowers have been pollinated. Yeah. Throw that on there.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
That sounds like a lot of work.
It can be, but, you know, currants are pretty awesome, too.
Mm-hmm. They're pretty. If they blossom, you can just enjoy the pretty flowers and hope about that. 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Because we have so many emails, we're just going to take another one of those. Rico writes, I have Ligularia, Osiris Cafe Noir. I want to know if I can split it or take a cutting for propagation, or basically, how do I make more of them? And is there a trick to knowing which plants you can split and which you have to clone?
I'm sure that you could split this Ligularia, Rico, but to be on the safe side, I would point you toward the Arboretum's fabulous propagation booklet, which costs only $6.50 from the Arboretum gift shop, called Cuttings Through the Year. And that tells you, for all manner of plants, which propagation method is easiest and what time of year to do it.
Oh, well, that seems handy.
Oh, it's great. I love it.
Okay. Propagation throughout the... Cuttings through the year. Okay, Rico, go to the Arboretum, to the little store, and it's actually kind of a big store.
It's a wonderful shop.
It is a wonderful shop. We're talking gardening, and I said call, so everybody called. Hi, Paula and Ken Moore, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a bottle bush plant that when it was new, it bloomed every year, and it's really very glorious when it blooms. Over the years, it's stopped. It's only blooming maybe a third or a quarter, and so we tried pruning it, and can never tell whether the pruning helps the blooming or not. What do you think?
Have any of the conditions surrounding the bottle bush changed?
No,
sunshine.
It's gotten bigger.
It's gotten bigger. Is it in more shade than it used to be?
Nope.
Because it's a full sun plant.
Yeah, it's full sun. I don't fertilize it much.
And it's in the ground?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, but it looks healthy otherwise.
Yes, the leaves or the needles are perfectly green and...
Yeah. It could be, when you've pruned it, at what time of year do you prune it?
We did it in the early spring, like March.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it blooms on new wood or old wood, so that would be something to check. If it blooms on old wood, that means you're probably cutting off some of the flowers because the stems that grew the previous year would be the ones that would have the flowers.
Okay.
So you might want to experiment with that.
Do you think is pruning better in the fall for this one?
Well, normally you think about pruning shrubs, flowering shrubs, after they flower. And then the growth they put on will provide flowers for next year. Or at least you'll...
Good. Well, I'm doing it the wrong time of year.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks. I hope that solved the problem. That would seem such an easy solution, wouldn't it?
I hope so.
Our Green Days gardening panel is here. A lot of calls now. Matt is in Everett. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Hello.
I've got a honeysuckle that I planted 3 years ago that's growing up a trellis. And the first year got attacked by earwigs and didn't do well. And last year, I think it got hit by lack of water and heat. And this year, all the growth seems to be happening on top of the trellis, and all the stuff that's growing through the lattice is just bare wood. Is there a fix, or should I start over?
I'd start over with hops or kiwi or yeah, that it seems like I so often see honeysuckles that stretch tall and then they're down at the lower heights, they're just leafless and mm-hmm. twiggy and turn into kind of a bird's nest mat rather than looking very good. So I'm not sure if some supplemental pruning would get some new growth coming from the base.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it would. Yeah. Honeysuckles are pretty tough plants, and I'm sure if you cut it back hard into that wood, you may not see any flowers this year, but you may be able to start over again that way.
So cut it down to almost ground level or kind of
quickly
start over?
And if you want to keep it still over the top, you don't have to take all the stems down to ground level. Just cut off some of the stems coming up, and that'll get you some fill-in growth.
Okay. Can you think of any reason why the little earwigs were attacking it?
Earwigs just sometimes have years where they get hungry.
Earwigs have Catholic tastes. They, you know, anything. They don't care.
It probably the same reason we like honeysuckle. It's delicious.
Yeah. And as a new planting it that year, it would have possibly been undergoing some transplant shock, and stressed plants are generally more susceptible to insect damage.
Hmm. Well, Matt, sounds like either the advice is either cut it down hard or cut it down.
Or Greg's advice, plant hops.
I like Greg's advice.
Plant hops. Good luck with that. Thanks for your call. I had a very lovely honeysuckle that always had horrible problems, mildew. It was harder than roses, I have to say. We're talking gardening with our Green Days panel, as we do every Tuesday at this time. Judy in Issaquah says, when is the best time to split hostas?
Late fall, very early spring. The thing about hostas is once they die back, you think, where did that hosta go? Unless it's a really old plant, and then you can see the little points of where it will grow next.
So you're saying do it when you know it, where it is?
Yeah, but don't do it right now because they look really pretty.
They are really pretty right now. Hi, Emily on Capitol Hill. You're on the air.
Hello. I have a question about earwigs, too, and slugs. I've had a lot of damage to bean seedlings, and I put down some slug traps with beer in them, just cups in the ground with beer. And what I found was that there were a few slugs, but there were dozens of earwigs that went into those cups. And so I'm wondering, is this a really bad year for earwigs? Do you have any suggestions for how to deal with them? And then also, what are your suggestions for slugs? In my organic garden, we've had a big discussion about sluggo and if it's appropriate or not.
Yeah, well, you know, the beer traps are capturing a couple of things. Are you seeing better growth on your beans?
Yeah, it did help.
Then I would continue what you're doing because it's working.
Even though they're really disgusting to empty.
They are so disgusting.
Yeah, they're pretty slimy.
That's what you recommend?
I love beer traps for slugs, and I haven't personally had a lot of trouble with earwigs, but if you're catching a lot of them, they're probably in there doing some damage too. So, you know, you're getting your critters and your beans can grow. I use them especially around dahlias because slugs love to eat the tops down and you can't get them growing. Once you get a beer trap in place, that plant gets to grow enough so that I don't care if the slugs eat the bottom leaves anymore once it grows up high enough. So,
okay.
All right.
And what can you tell me about using sluggo?
Sluggo is an iron phosphate-based product. If you look at the label, the basic sluggo is a certified organic product. So it has been certified for organic use. It breaks down, you know, and fertilizes the ground. Some people are concerned because it's iron. Iron can be a little harsh on soil critters, but it's such a small amount that I doubt that it's doing a huge amount of damage. It's pretty effective, but personally, I like the beer trap.
The answer, Emily, is that it's not a bad product, but but Laura likes beer.
It's still a product.
Cheap beer. Yeah, cheap beer. That's
yeah,
the thing.
Cheap beer. Good luck. That's why she wants you to grow hops. Good luck with that. We have a honeysuckle remedy from Rebecca. We hard pruned ours back to the base last year. It's back with flowers. We planted peonies in front of it to hide that ugly base and an evergreen clematis to climb the porch with it, and it all looks great.
Excellent. So, oh, I'd like to see those two duke it out.
Yeah, I know.
Barbara in Kirkland says, hello, we're overrun with mountain beavers. They were once cute. Now they're a major nuisance. I've stuffed their tunnel entry holes with ammonia-soaked, wadded-up newspaper. I've filled every tunnel entry hole I can find with soiled cat litter. Ew. I can see them digging new holes and laughing at me. Question, how dangerous are these mountain beavers to our hillside ravine, and how do we get rid of them?
I'm just picturing the little mountain beavers in there cleaning their den with these ammonia-soaked rags.
The windows they put in.
Yeah, bringing out the luster. There's a great site that talks Living with Wildlife. It's a fantastic book by Russell Link. And almost the entire book is also online at Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. So you can go there for recommendations. But in general, you can barriers are usually your most effective deterrent, as far as you can create floppy fences, which are generally pretty ugly. They're not hard fences that they can climb. And you can create barriers. You can overplant and expect some mortality. They are a native wildlife that's part of the ecosystem and, you know, one of nature's rototillers. So I generally try and live with things and adjust accordingly by densely planting and overplanting. So if I have some plant mortality here and there, well, I can live with it. That said, the Living with Wildlife also recommends you can be a noisy neighbor, and that sometimes works, continually harassing them. To me, it's more that would becomes more work than it just.
I'm just imagining you shoo beaver.
Exactly, it'd be like going head to head with vandalizing teenagers. You know, they're always going to stay up later and have more time, so there's really no point in even heading down that path.
So I guess then, Barbara, what Greg is saying is like learn a Zen acceptance of the mountain beavers in your yard. Is that it? We'll go back to the phone. Susan in Seward Park, thank you so much for holding. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I love this program.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you.
I've done a terrible thing. I have a Nandina, which is in a pot, and I put it under a cedar tree, and it's been there for a long time now. It looks beautiful, but I cannot pull that pot up now.
I have a ceanothus that I put in a pot on our gravel patio, and I'm not moving that pot anytime, that's for sure. So the Nandina has gone through the drain hole in the pot into the ground. Do you want to move it?
No, but I worry about the health of it. Although it's doing well now.
Yeah, I think don't worry about it. You could. If you felt like you needed to put it someplace else, what you would need to do is cut underneath the pot and cut the root off and then break the pot and take the Nandina someplace else and plant it. But if you don't mind the way it's growing and where it's growing, if it looks good, then there you are.
Oh, that's great. Thank you very much.
Good news, Susan. So don't just enjoy it. Go look at it and enjoy it. Thanks for your call. We go next to Vashon Island. Hello, Juniper.
Hi there. This is a question that I posted on the Facebook page, and while that should have been enough, I'm feeling really tenacious and sad about these poplars on our property, and also an old willow, and they all sort of seem to be having the same problem. It's like they leafed out normally late winter, early spring, and then all the leaves have died, but they're still on the tree, and now it's sort of producing some sort of anemic-looking new growth. And Greg had suggested that we needed to take them out, and that may be the answer. But because it's also happening with the willow, I wasn't sure if we should expect that is it something that would be airborne and causing the same problem between these two trees, or if we should get an arborist out, or if there's any hope for any of these trees.
I would get an arborist out when you're having, especially to determine if something's crossing between the different species. I think it's really important to find out what that disease is, because one might actually have one problem and one another. And when it comes to tree removal, that can be really stressful if you really like those trees. So it's worth, that way you don't have regrets later when you get a second opinion, get somebody professional out there to ID the disease.
Great. And is that enough to, I mean, I'm obviously an arborist, but are there folks like Plant Amnesty that would also do it, or really just stick with an arborist and go from there?
Well, Plant Amnesty has a great referral service to different arborists. That's essentially what they do. They have a certification that goes one step beyond what our state arborist association does.
Oh, okay. Great.
So. Good luck with that, Juniper. And we're going to go squeeze in a last phone call from Stephen on Capitol Hill in Seattle. Hi, Stephen.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, I've got tomato plants in my backyard, and I'm wondering if at this stage I should still be picking the blossoms, the little new blossoms off the tomato, or should I let those go and hope they turn into fruit?
No, no, you should be letting those be now. You want to develop fruit. It's that time of year.
Okay.
All right. That's an easy question. Thanks for your call. Mickey writes in, Sluggo is not a harmless product. The label says it's safe for pets, but it's not. We had two dogs hospitalized because they licked up Sluggo from the garden, which then formed a dough-like lump in their stomach and blocked their intestinal tract. Mm. $2,000 later, we don't use Sluggo. And Patrick, I hope you put this on our Green Days page on Facebook, the origin of the word earwig from a TED Talk by Jessica Orrick and Rachel Teal. So he says you got to love the vernacular. And with that, gardeners, this is high season, so our panel will be back next week. Laura Matter is a practicing horticulturalist and coordinator for Seattle Tilth's Garden Hotline. Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin steward and co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. And Marty Wingett has written many books about small gardens and gardening for privacy. You can find them at, or links to them at her website, martywingett.com. She also writes about gardening and travel together and take some really cool trips. So, you know, someday.
Yeah, you wanna, Scotland next year.
Yeah, that sounds fun to me. Our show, produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and Amina Alsadi. I'm Marcy Silman. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. Hope you join us tomorrow at 9 here on KUOW.
It's 10:59, and I've got a question for you. When you're hanging out with your best friend, do you speak differently than you do when you talk with your boss or when you talk with a police officer? Most of us do. The way you change the way you talk around different people or groups is called code switching. We're going to be talking about code switching later today during the noon hour, and we'd like to hear from you on this ahead of time. Call and tell us when and how you code switch. And give us an example if you can. Here's the number to call, 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. Code switching. When and how do you do it and why? Join us for that today at noon. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from City People's Mercantile on Sandpoint Way and City People's Garden Store and Landscape Design in Madison Valley, offering a wide selection of plants, patio furniture, and outdoor living accessories. Locally owned for more than 30 years. More at citypeoples.com.
One day, Sugata Mitra took a computer and he stuck it in a wall in a neighborhood in New Delhi.
Just to see.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.